the platform. Step up and speak out.
It's a good evening. It's the FM Stereo, my station, your station, the hottest radio in town. Thank you very much for joining us. It is the platform. It's just gone 29 minutes before the hour of 8 o'clock. I'm with you until half past the hour of 8 o'clock. Afterwards, Chila comes with our story. And before I talk about what we have on the show today, which I think is a very enthralling topic, it's a very important topic for us to get involved in, Kama TV, Wange 105.1, Vic Falls 106.5, Gweru 104.3, and Abulaya, my hometown, 106.7, and we're broadcasting out of Harare, where our frequency is 106.4. Listen to us over the internet. It's www.zfmstereo.co.zw. Over the internet, it's... that's what you can listen to us. But if you want to download the TuneIn app, it's available for free. It's just go to whatever app store that you use and just look for ZFM Stereo, and you can listen to us live and in charge using whatever internet connection you have. WhatsApp number is open. It's 0731 168 045, and our call-in number 0772 168 045. On Twitter, it's at ZFM Stereo. On Facebook, it's facebook.com/ZFM Stereo. Now, of course, we are in a period in which we're over the last two days we were mourning over the unfortunate loss of life that took place in Chimanimani and the environs after Cyclone Idai hit this part of the world. And our souls we wish well for the souls of those people that passed away, and hope their souls rest in peace. And a lot of the talk has been about the great response that was there among Zimbabweans after the fact. But I want to talk about what happens before the fact. Because we know the International Federation of Red Cross, as well as the Red Crescent Societies, the world's largest humanitarian networks, define disaster preparedness. And this is what we're going to talk about today, as measures taken to prepare for and reduce the effects of disasters. Okay, that is to predict and, where possible, prevent disasters, mitigate their impact on vulnerable populations, and respond to and effectively cope with their consequences. At some point, I'll come back and I'll remind you more about that. Now, prior to Cyclone Idai, the Meteorological Services Department of Zimbabwe had warned that at least four provinces in Zimbabwe would be affected negatively by Tropical Cyclone Idai. Now, in the studio today, I've got three guests. First of all, from VAR, I've got from the renewable energy energy engineer and trustee for the People and Earth Solidarity Network, that's Christine Juta. Also in here, I've got Lenin Tinashe Chisaira, who is an environment lawyer, executive director for People and Earth Solidarity Law Network. And also here, Professor Desmond Manatsa, who is the Dean at the Faculty of Science and Engineering at the Bindura University of Science Education. Congratulations on your recent elevation, Prof.
Thank you. Good evening, viewers.
Okay, we're going to start off, and welcome to all of you to the show. The question is, you obviously are experts. I read it out for you, but I'm sure you're experts on preparedness. So we'll start with Professor Manatsa with you. Using Cyclone Idai as an example, did we prepare, in terms as far as the definition is concerned, for this tropical cyclone sufficiently?
We cannot say that we were really prepared, because Cyclone Idai had it was very complex. One, the magnitude of the hazard was unprecedented. We had experience with tropical cyclone Elin, which had some devastations, and it caused millions of dollars of damage. But now Cyclone Idai came with another dimension. It was slow moving, which means it was dumping a lot of moisture or a lot of rainfall per unit area, more than tropical cyclone Elin. And the second one is that it came during the night when people are asleep. So here we cannot actually say that we're not really prepared, because it had added a certain complexity to what we really know about dealing with tropical cyclones.
But surely this cyclone didn't just appear the night before and just rained on that day. Can you still say that is the case, in spite of the fact that we saw that even when it was in the ocean and when it came onto land, that there was, this was not a business as usual type of cyclone.
Well, yes, you can say that, because before this tropical cyclone hit Zimbabwe, it was it hit Beira, in Beira first in Mozambique, and that was 2 days before. And the warning was issued by the Meteorological Service, just like what we have said. And I think what we did is that we took a casual approach. We just thought that this tropical cyclone is just like another tropical cyclone, which was not going to hit Zimbabwe. That's what I think. That is why there was not that much agency which was put in evacuating people.
I'm going to come to you, Christine, on the other side. Your opinion, were we prepared, or, and he's talking about we didn't put urgency, did we know that it was going to be this heavy?
Okay, thank you very much for that, Larry. I'm just going to start by giving perspective on who we are as PES and where we are coming from. So we are a team of nonprofits, a nonprofit team of lawyers, researchers, and engineers working on research in terms of the impact of our activities on the environment. And from a technical perspective, looking at our preparedness for this disaster, as the prof highlighted, we were really ill prepared, and we took a rather casual approach. And while everybody else seems to be alluding to our preparedness in terms of evacuating people, I would also like to talk about preparedness in terms of resilience of the infrastructure we have in the country, particularly in these regions where we have which experience the effects of this cyclone. I would like to say that given the fact that we are in the generation of climate change, we need to start looking at our preparedness in terms of the infrastructure we have in these areas. Are we really, even as we are going to be rebuilding, are we going to be building structures that are, because these disasters are going to keep on coming. Climate change is here and it's a reality, and we need to start talking about resilience in terms of our infrastructure, the rapidness of our response. Like he said, a warning was issued 2 days before, but it was really paining to learn that there were entire schools where people are missing, and one would argue why those schools were, people were not evacuated, for instance, in those schools. It's really quite disheartening, and I think we cannot really put it all on the government on that one, because I mean, even from the authorities on the school, from the schools, for instance, the parents of the children, everybody should have really taken this more seriously, and I would say lessons have been learned. We were definitely ill prepared for this.
So can we talk about it being ill prepared? Let's talk about, for example, I'm going to use it might be a false equivalent, if we want to use it in this aspect. Like, for example, the shooting that happened in New Zealand, and they're saying we've never had it to this extent, and therefore they came up with laws and said, you know what, we're going to change the laws and make it a lot more better. Can the same be used as an equivalent to say, okay, because we've never been hit by something this big, therefore it means that we did the best we could have under the circumstances?
Yeah. Oh, thanks a lot, Larry, first for inviting us on the show.
So in case you're listening and that's Lenny Chisaira, who is a environment lawyer, please carry on.
I mainly look at it from a legal and police perspective. First and foremost, I wouldn't say this is a unique thing. Yeah, it is unique because this is the first cyclone Idai. We've had other cyclones, though, with different names. But what I can say is that in our context as Zimbabwe, this is barely a month when we had another disaster. This is not the first disaster to hit us in 2019. We have had the Battlefields mine disaster. And for us as an organization, as PES lawyers, after the Battlefields disaster, we actually came up with a report which we called God Capitalism and Disaster Preparedness in Zimbabwe. And one of our recommendations was that our disaster institutions, our disaster management institutions, in this case the Civil Protection Unit, we felt that it was very underprepared to deal with any disaster in Zimbabwe. So as Chris said and as the professor said, we are now in the era of climate change, where we are going to have lots of these climate-related disasters, where we are going to have lots of these cyclones, hurricanes, heat waves, and other and storms. So definitely, we can't really say that this caught us unaware. We are just caught unprepared, but we were very unaware. Our disaster responsive institutions and responsible authorities, they were aware that a disaster was coming, but they were ill-prepared to deal with it. And that is very serious implications on our laws and on the human and environmental rights of our people.
So, given that sort of context, we've laid the groundwork to say, okay, we're not prepared as much as we could have. But I will tell you that I was sitting getting text messages from, you know, the CPU saying, hey, you need to be careful. The Meteorological Services Department was saying you need to get onto higher ground, even though I was in Harare. But I saw the gravity of this. Mm-hmm. So the gravity of the communication around how serious it was wasn't one of those like it's going to be heavy rain. It's going to be pretty devastating. So if we knew it was going to be devastating, maybe not this devastating, why didn't we do something? And are there systems in place to deal with things of this nature, based on what you know about the policies that are in place? Professor Malas.
Yes. Actually, when the warnings were issued, even on the text messages that were sent by CPU, I think the most the bad thing that we did was that we took a casual approach. We just thought it's just a forecast, the usual forecast, and then we didn't put the gravity that it was supposed to be to accompany that forecast. And now, like I said, we've had tropical cyclones before, but now because of climate change, the intensity of these tropical cyclones have increased. So basically, the bottom line is that the disaster is occurred, and we have seen the effects. So what we have to do now is to become more prepared, so that next time when we have when these forecasts are issued, we don't take a casual approach like what we did.
0731 168 045. Babakari says, why didn't you get information from Mozambique just to prepare? So why is it important to have weather forecasts which is not just for farmers? I think there was a report today in which this is part of the information preparedness aspect, that there's now Cyclone Joannina, which is out in the Indian Ocean. It's not going to come to Zimbabwe. I'll play you a clip a little bit later from the Honorable Minister of Information, and as far as that is concerned, how social media also has played a part in sometimes maybe communication which may come across as intense, but some people maybe play it down on social media. And also, some people make it sound worse than it is, although I don't think you can make anything worse than what Cyclone Idai was. How do we prepare for such a situation, especially when it comes from a policy aspect, fighting misinformation?
Okay, that's an interesting one, and I like that you bring in social media, because like you highlighted, we did receive text messages warning us about the impending cyclone. But I think it's one thing to send messages to people warning them of the cyclones or whatever natural disaster could be coming our way, where we have warnings. It's a totally different thing to actually deploy people on the ground to enforce whatever measures need to be taken. In this instance, like I highlighted earlier, people needed to be evacuated, and I think some of them, it's regrettable, because we could have saved a lot more, many lives, had action been taken on the ground. We're talking about sending messages on Twitter, on Facebook. Some of the people who have been affected live in rural areas. Some of the people do not have access to social media. For instance, I mean, at most, a tweet from the Ministry of Information could reach a certain number of people. But we've got more people who are on the ground in different areas. So there's need for a multi-pronged approach in terms of dispersing information. And also, for instance, like in the rural areas, there are traditional means of communication. We've got chiefs and headmen in these villages, and it would be ideal to use them as well, to rope them in terms of disseminating information and emphasizing the gravity of the situation. Because I think the problem we had here was information may have reached people, but no one really had a fair understanding of what it is people were talking about. So perhaps maybe you just say there's a cyclone coming, but no one has really gone out of their way to really explain further to the people who are most likely to be affected about the dangers which are impending. I remember reading a message which was circulating on social media, not too sure how far true it was, about a man who refused to move from his property because he wanted to take care of his bicycle and some personal effects. But I think if people are aware of what exactly it is we're talking about when we issue such warnings, then people can also take them seriously and also take heed to these warnings beyond just reading messages on social media and circulating them. And also with social media as well, there's an element of people are very cautious about consuming fake news, so it's always important for formal means of communication to be employed where necessary, because they are traditional. I think maybe people are more likely to believe a message that has been the responsible authorities give it a press statement rather than a message circulating on WhatsApp, because it could or could not be true. So there's also that need to dispel fake news by more formal means of communication, as well as having people on the ground to actually ensure people understand the message that is being put through to them.
But I understand when people say that there should be a more focus on, you know, what you define as credible sources and official statements. But Lennon, I want to come back to you and say that example of someone who says that who didn't want to leave their wares, in spite of the fact that there's water that's crashing and so forth. How do you deal with, say, for example, told them that, hey, you know what, this is worse than Cyclone Aline. And you'll say, I lived through Cyclone Aline. So I've lived through the worst cyclone in living memory before you die. How do you get across to that person? And how do you then create government policy that make sure that there's better communication with people who are not inclined to believe from the first go that the information is credible, or that sometimes they might feel like, you know what, I can survive this.
that's a very interesting perspective. I would first start with agreeing with what Christian has said. You know, we need this early warning system. We also call them early warning systems. This should be deployed where we have ICT hardware, softwares in these raw areas, be it in the form of radio communications, be it in the form of SMS messages, whereby people in these areas that can be adversely affected by climate change, that can be adversely affected by these weather disasters, can be able to have a constant form of communication, not just when it comes to a disaster, when we are aware that within a week there's going to be cyclone Idai. But it should be something that is continuous. You know, these early warning systems, they are recommended. They should be there in all of these areas, informing people about impending disasters, even about wildfires, even about these heat waves and all the other forms of weather-related disasters. Then when it comes to the issue said, well, the issue of relying on the news or trying to make sure that people don't end up saying this is fake news or anything. One, if it is continuous, people will end up relying on this form of news as a source, on these forms of information as a source. And if we are to look at our laws, the composition of the civil protection units, they are made up of some of the institutions that are supposed to be very credible. For instance, in terms of our Civil Protection Act, the civil protection units are supposed to be made up of representatives from the local authorities and people in rural areas. Usually listen to the instructions that come from these local authorities. They usually rely on information from local authorities. So What just lagged is that hardware, that early warning system that should be there for people in the rural areas. Because we have some of the institutions that you can't really argue with, you know. We have the local authorities, we have the fire brigades, we have the people from the health services, from the health ministries, we have people from the military. You know, all the security services sectors are part of our civil protection units. People from the military, from the police, from the prisons, the fire brigades. So I really think that we just need, as a nation and as people who live in parts of the world that are going to be adversely affected by climate change and these disasters more often, we need to have these early warning systems that people can then continue to rely on. Not just to say people should then rely on social media, should rely on messages that come when we're already faced with a disaster.
I've got a message here, 0731 168045. Gwenzu at Gweru says, I saw a message on my phone telling people to stay indoors and not to wander about the same houses that were swept away by the cyclone. So you can see that even the civil protection unit did not know what they were warning people about. I want to come back after the break, because that critical aspect of communication, where some people may believe that I know some people say I don't read local news or I don't listen to anything that's got to do with local. How do you get through to those people? Because they're going to need access to those warning systems. If somebody says they just don't get access to this information. They can tell you what's happening on international news channels, but they can't tell you about what's happening in their own country. What policies can be put in place? And secondly, when it comes to evacuation, what can or what cannot be done, especially when you're talking around international practices, especially with the IOM and things of that nature. Is ZFM Stereo my station, your station, the hottest radio in town?
We've got the stars and we've got the power. Proudly Zimbabwean. Proudly CFM Stereo.
News, lifestyle, charts, live radio, station highlights, and much more. Get it all on cfmstereo.co.zw.
The platform. Step up and speak up.
You're indeed tuned into ZFM Stereo, my station, your station, the hottest radio in town. Larry created I here on the platform. And just to remind you, 0731 168045, that's our WhatsApp number that is already open. If you want to go contribute via call in, it's 0772 168045. My guests in the studio are Professor Desmond Manatsa, who is the Dean of the Faculty of Science and Engineering at the Bindura University of Science and Education. Lennon Tunashi Chisaira, who is an environmental lawyer and executive director at the People and Earth Solidarity Law Network, and at the same organization, the renewable energy engineer and trustee, that is Christine Jutta. Before the break, how do you deal with that trust gap where somebody says, okay, you know what, I'm not going to read a certain newspaper because I just don't trust them, maybe because of political persuasion, whatever the case may be. And, you know, some people say, I'm not going to read these annoying text messages that keep coming in. These are warnings to save lives. How do you deal with that trust gap where people start believing that when you get that message, it's important?
Yeah, the most important thing is that what lagged, especially when a tropical cyclone Idai came, is that the people were ill prepared and they had not been trained. Even if the warnings were issued, they didn't know what to do with the warnings. So my opinion is that there should be a lot of training for the community, and a task force should be created, which when a warning has been issued reacts, so that when the community sees the task force in action, they know that something really is, they mean business. So by as in the case, what happened is that the warnings were issued, but there was no movement on the ground to show the gravity of the warning. So what I'm trying to say is that I think the community has to be trained first, and a task force has to be put in place which put the warning into action, so that when people see movement on the ground, they really know that things are not business as usual.
And I've got a message here that's coming in, and I want to segue a question into Christine Jutta over there. I think there is need for on-field drills to teach people about these disasters, not just posting on WhatsApp or on social media. And adding on to that, we often just bandy around this phrase, climate change. How much do people know what climate change is, especially in areas that are mostly expected to suffer from it? And what can we do if there's a knowledge gap?
Okay, thank you for that. You put it very, 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 very correctly there. People generally do not really have a fair understanding of what climate change is. And where they do, people tend to push climate change discussions or issues to the peripheries. People think that climate change has nothing to do with the economy. People think climate change has nothing to do with politics. People are more concerned with money and politics. But I'm sure from this... From incidences such as Cyclone Idai and some of the natural disasters which are finding themselves hitting us nowadays, I hope people realize the serious economic implications and economic impacts of these natural disasters, which are related to the effects of climate change. For instance, right now we're talking about lives that have been lost, people have been displaced. There's also issues to do with for people in the rural areas. Livestock have been lost as well. Those are the sources of livelihoods. That's a direct impact. People have lost their crops, although of course there was we were facing a drought, but people have lost entire farming season has gone to waste. So for people to realize that when we talk about climate change, the effects of climate change have got direct implication on your lifestyle. It's got direct implication on what you eat, where you live, for instance. Right now people have been displaced, but it's a climate change issue. So I'd love to see a lot more advocacy programs and awareness programs to really emphasize the effect of climate change. There's this misconception that climate change is only affecting perhaps countries in the West, for instance.
Or just farmers.
Exactly.
Just going to have less food.
But
or
right now, with the destruction that has hit Beira, for instance, people are talking about issues to do with whether or not we're going to have enough fuel reaching us, for instance. Now, that will affect somebody who was not even in Chimanimani, for instance. You're in Harare here today, but it's going to have a direct effect on you as well. So I think there's a lot, definitely a gap in terms of advocacy for people to have a thorough understanding on the effects of climate change and what can be done to mitigate that and how do we adapt. For instance, as the prof was alluding to, we are probably going to be seeing more and more of these disasters coming our way from an environmental perspective. We need to adapt so that we have these response mechanisms that are put in place at community level so that everybody knows what we're dealing with.
But having said that, I often say, for example, the reason why the internet is not as fully understood in a lot of rural communities is it's spoken about in a very English and Western way. Have we started, or what do you think should be done as far as policy is concerned to make sure that things such as climate change are broken down to the person living within the communities affected, that this is what it will, how it will actually affect you, especially from a policy perspective?
Yeah, I think we really need to utilize the institutions that are relied upon by these people in the rural areas. For instance, the traditional leaders. In terms of our general environmental law, you know that traditional leaders have a bigger role to play, you know, in educating the people about environmental issues, in conserving the environment. That is actually a critical part of the Traditional Leaders Act. So what needs to be done is these civil protection departments, these ministries that are responsible for informing people about disasters, about the effects of climate change, they also need to work with, you know, with the raw structures, the traditional leaders, the local authorities, the councillors, because, you know, in the rural areas, those are the areas where an office such as the office of the council is greatly respected as compared to the urban environment. So we just need to utilize, the structures are there. I can actually say most of the structures are there. We have the traditional leaders in place in the rural areas. We have the teachers in place in the rural areas. We have even church leaders. We have civil society organizations. We have community-based organizations, especially in Manicaland. We have lots of community-based organizations. And they are in interaction with community members of the villagers on a daily basis. Those are the structures that should be utilized. So as a lawyer, I would actually say maybe there's need for us to relook at our Civil Protection Act to make sure that we include all those other structures that have not been part of the discourse. You know, like I said before, at the moment, our civil protection unit in terms of the law, it's made up of the military, it's made up of the police, the prisons, it's made up of the fire brigades, the Zimbabwe Red Cross. But these other structures that have come up recently, if the traditional leaders, they are not part of those civil protection units, but they hold a great sway in the rural areas. So those are some of the structures that we need to work with in the time of climate change.
Policymakers in Zimbabwe are reactionary instead of being proactive. The government was supposed to take action after the Met Department had issued a warning of impending disaster. Furthermore, after what happened in Moza and Malawi, we should have evacuated. It says, get Danisa, some areas have no access to radio or TV. Someone is not doing his or her job. They're only enjoying the comfort of their offices. Heads must roll. That's Sifela Nimbongeni Tabangana, who is in Ilanda in Bulawayo. I know that this is reactionary, and you know every reaction is valid. But what is there to learn from this, especially from the aspect of... Okay, what is there to learn in as far as this is concerned, especially from the aspect of the action that needs to be taken? I know we've spent a lot of time talking about what is wrong, and I want people, for you at home or wherever you are, on 0772-168-045, call me, or on WhatsApp 0731-168-045. In the instances of such an impending disaster, what should be done? We've had some ideas here that I think that have been mentioned by our guests here from PES lawyers, is to say, you know, having trigger systems that are more localized. What else can be done, especially in as far as deploying assistance in the event of such a thing happening?
Yeah, I think. When we have a disaster of such magnitude and warnings have been issued, like I said before, there should be a system that is put in place which makes sure that the community is aware of the gravity of the impending disaster, and they actually initiate the action that is expected to be taken by the community. And if the warning is issued and there is no if the warning has been issued and then there is only the warning with no action attached to it, then people may tend to ignore it.
So the question I ask, and this, you can either one of you can answer this question. Some people have suggested that a lot of the time the areas that are affected do not have local command centers that are able to react quickly. Say in this instance where now it's happened, and a lot of the time the help is coming from Harare or somewhere else. Is that a worry?
I think that's a very interesting perspective. I haven't really thought of it from that perspective. But what I can say is that almost all the areas in Zimbabwe, you know, all the villages, they do have some areas of authority or some institutions relating to authority. You know, from each household in the rural areas, there is a village head, there is a headman, there is a chief, and those are the institutions that are usually used to rely to, you know, to forward this information. We can't really delve deep into it, but we have had issues like, you know, we have political systems, and we know that
I get
the
you.
Nasty household.
No, but what we need to deal with is something that Christine Jutta touched on a little bit earlier: the design planning of the area. Shouldn't we have some people who are there doing the design planning, whether it's now, for example, we know that the Eastern Highlands are the ones that are probably going to be hit by heavy rains and cyclones. They're most likely to get hit by heavy rains and cyclones. Shouldn't we already be saying, okay, there must be some sort of
design planning around those areas in order to make sure that, you know, whatever systems of response after the fact are effective?
Yeah, I think what you're talking about is a risk assessment. They should actually, we know that the Eastern Highlands, they are the one, they are the areas which are most prone to tropical cyclones because they reach those areas when the intensity is still high. So I think what is supposed to be done initially is to do risk assessment. By risk assessment, I mean to look at areas, assess the areas which are at high risk. And then if you identify the areas which are at high risk, then you put some structures which when a warning has been issued, people are deployed to those areas of high risk. Listen, so basically what I'm trying to say is that a risk assessment is very, very much important so that you identify the areas of high risk.
I guess somebody is talking about this and someone can respond. What if you can respond to this? There's been a way about the Panjera Dam being weak and people should move to higher ground, although that's been saying that it's a little bit safe. But what you're talking about is higher ground, that people should, and then that people who have relatives around that area should warn them. Why don't they just remove those people while there is time? That's another argument. Someone said, once you do the risk assessment and you know that there's certain areas that no matter what you do, it's just never going to be safe. How do you convince those people that they should leave there, an area which they've lived there for the past 100 years, for example?
Okay, I would say on that one, yes, we have heard that the warning has been issued with that dam. But for instance, those people may not necessarily have the resources to afford, to be able to move. I mean, you don't just get up and go. You need shelter where you're going to be going. So in as much as we might issue warnings and urge people to move to safe, to higher ground or to move to safer areas, have we created a safe space for them to go to? Is there a temporary shelter where structures been put in place to accommodate these people? Where are they going to get food, for instance? Some of these people live from hand to mouth, relying on their subsistence farming. So if we're going to ask people to move, it's going to take a lot more than just telling people that you could be flooded. We need to create and I think this speaks to what the prof was alluding to, that once we do risk assessment, we need localized task forces which actually then implement and enforce these warnings to ensure that people do in fact move to higher ground. Because I mean, to urge your relatives to move to higher ground when you're not necessarily aiding them in any way to do so is really not very sincere.
So then what would an action plan around that actually look? For example, what would it look like? When you're told 10 days from now there's going to be a cyclone, what would the action plan look like?
Yeah, personally I would think if we have our structures in place, there's the issue of people are being told to move, for example, to higher ground or to safer grounds, then those areas must be adequately be prepared to receive large volumes of people.
But how are the people moving? For example, let's say there's 100,000 people that need to move.
Well, that's an extreme example, but I would say in most of these villages of ours, we have yet, at the end of the day, you know, as a reactive response, people actually moving to higher ground, people actually moving to some safer places, schools, churches, that way a bit safer. But what we need to do is that when we realize that Manicaland is an area that is going to be adversely affected by these weather-related disasters for a very long time, you know, we should have learned from Cyclone Eline, we now have Cyclone Idai. We should have structures that are prepared to receive these people. You know, not really, we don't have large volumes of people in some of these affected areas because there are some settlements that were grossly affected. There are some villages that were grossly affected. But where people can actually be moved to a centralized location. What we need to do is to work with such institutions such as the Zimbabwe Red Cross, which incidentally is actually part of our civil protection units. The Zimbabwe Red Cross is specifically mentioned in the Civil Protection Act as part of the Civil Protection Committees, Civil Protection Units, Civil Protection Departments. So they have the capacity, you know, the Red Cross, they have the capacity to house that, such numbers of people as long as they are adequately capacitated in time. So I would actually say we just need to have from a policy perspective, we need to have our policies that provide for a certain amount of money that should go to disaster preparedness, that should go to those centers where we can then house internally displaced persons in the time of disaster.
Prisca from Portland in the U.S. has got a question for you over here. The question, Lennon, says, humans and animals were adversely affected by the cyclone. What are some of the impacts in the environment, particularly wildlife and animals? While response to assist human life has been very remarkable, what about the non-humans we share the planet with? Do response plans, if there are any, consider them?
Oh yeah, that's a very interesting perspective. You know, our organization is an environmental organization, and we were greatly concerned about the impact of this cyclone Idai on wildlife and on domestic animals. But I'm happy to say that there are a number of organizations that I have been in touch with, that are actually working on making sure that they try to put some resources towards rescuing some of these wildlife and some of these domestic animals. To give certain example, we have the Veterinarians Association for Animal Welfare in Zimbabwe, VAWS. They are actually working on the ground to try to ensure that they try to rescue and give assistance to some of these animals. So there are a number of organizations. We also have the Zimbabwe Youth Biodiversity Network. They've also been calling for response measures that cater for the welfare of animals that have been affected by these disasters. So definitely the response has been late, and most of the response indeed has been focused on animal or on human life. But I'm yet to say that quite a number of organizations have begun to come on board to say we also need to rescue wildlife, also need to rescue domestic animals that have been affected. But we are obviously going to have lots of losses, you know. There are some animals that we may not really know about, some creatures, birds, frogs, etc., that are going to be affected by this disaster. But as human beings, people are mainly going to focus on human life, but that's a very important person that can, actually say that a number of organizations that I've been in touch with, VAWS for instance, are actually working on ensuring that they rescue some animals, they provide for the welfare, you know, their veterinarians, and they're trying to cater for the welfare of some of these animals.
The question at the end of the day, I think, and that's the next question that's going to come up, we're going to take a break, is who is going to pay for this? Because all of this you're talking about costs money. Is the FM stereo, my station, your station, the hottest radio.
The platform. Step up and speak up.
Indeed, you're still on ZFM Stereo, my station, your station, the hottest radio in town. We are talking about the response and disaster preparedness to incidences or disasters like the cyclone Idai. As I said earlier on, the definition is the preparedness is taking measures to prepare for and reduce the effects of disasters. They're often referred to as acts of God because nobody knows when they will come most of the time. We're talking about the ability to predict and where possible prevent disasters, mitigate their impact on vulnerable populations, and respond to and effectively cope with their consequences. I've got three people here who are a lot smarter than me when it comes to this particular subject. Professor Desmond Manasa, Dean of Faculty in Science and Engineering at Buse. The question I'm going to ask next is, all of this we're talking about designing of you know, how we're going to build places, educate people about you know, climate change, focus on drills and things of that nature. They all cost money. And someone's suggesting there should be a fund to cater for the disasters after the occurrence, because it's a natural disaster. We cannot even prevent it from happening, but we can cater for the after effects. It's unexpected. It's unbudgeted for. So how do you deal with such a situation, especially someone will sit and say, like I said, Cyclone Eline was in 2003. This is 1999, sorry. Yeah. It's 20 years now.
Yes.
Trying to convince somebody 20 years of drills is important. How do you do that?
Yeah, it's...
And this is costs, and asking somebody... Every year, we're going to be asking Professor Mthuli Ncube, please give us money for drills. How do you convince that?
Yeah, I'm sure we've learned a lesson from Tropical Cyclone Idai and the magnitude of disasters and the magnitude of damage that it can cause. I think the responsible authorities they should be prepared to fund, to put more funds on disaster preparedness or disaster management or the disaster management cycle, the whole cycle of disaster management, so that when such type of disasters come, we'll be better prepared. But now, from the definition of disaster itself, it means that the communities that have been affected, the magnitude of the effects is beyond the capacity of the community to cope. So it needs external assistance. So what I'm saying here is that this disaster has befallen Zimbabwe, and it needs external assistance. It cannot cope with its own resources as Zimbabwe. So I think the other issue is that we should solicit for external funding from these other external agencies like the UN, UNDP, and all these other agencies which are there to assist in reducing disasters.
Christian Jutta, 20 years ago, person born 20 years ago would have been able to vote last year, right? Mm-hmm. As an adult, convincing that there should be repetitive action for the next 20 years. And by all accounts, what we experience with the Cyclone Idai is tons of times worse than what happened in Cyclone Aline, which itself was a massive disaster. And I'm sure discussions like this happened in 1999, how much we need to do better at X, Y, Z. And yet we're here. So how do we get that, particularly the financial commitment for the amazing things that you're suggesting, even that I talked about? How do we get that going? And is it sustainable to go and say, okay, can the United Nations fund disaster training for the next 20 years if we don't have another cyclone of this magnitude for that long?
Okay, well, whatever solution we are to implement has to be sustainable, and it should make economic sense as well. It may not necessarily, while it may not be viable to have a repetitive training, for instance, I'm sure we have so many brilliant young minds and across the country who can come up with innovative and less expensive ways of getting the message out there and ensuring that everybody is prepared for when these disasters take place. So suppose, for instance, maybe instead of having different structures in different areas, we could have a unique one set of people who are well equipped to respond quickly and effectively to a disaster which would have occurred within a certain radius, for instance. That might be less expensive and more and easier to implement than having multiple such structures or such activities taking place in different areas. And also, I think in this day and age, we can also take advantage of social media, for instance. It might not necessarily be a physical drill. It could be a video. It could be a documentary. Whatever it is, there has to be something that is less expensive, but which can actually have an impact and spread the message. So I would say there's need for people to go back to the drawing board and think of innovative solutions and ways to spread the message, which are not as costly, but can be sustained over time. And of course, there definitely is need for a disaster management fund, and if we have one at the moment, they might be need to revisit how much we are committing to that. And like the prof said, we don't have to go this alone. There are arms in place, organizations in place which could help if they are formally approached. So there would also be a need to make those formal appeals where we are not able to go it alone. But I think the first point of call is actually self-introspection and realizing what we can do for ourselves at the moment, how far we can go on our own, and then reaching out for external help.
In 2014, Toko Mokosi disaster happened. And there was again chat around, we need to do A, B, C, D. Some of the things I'm hearing them again today. How do you get
the commitment going that there is a follow-through on that, and what sort of policies from a legal perspective should there be in place for this to happen?
Oh yeah, now you mentioned Tugwe Nkosi, it's now called Tugwe Nkosi.
Tugwe Nkosi.
Yeah. But that's what I said from the beginning, that as an organization, we came up with a preliminary report soon after the Battlefield disaster, you know, the latest disaster, way after Tugwe Nkosi. And we had this as part of our recommendations, that we really need to relook at our disaster management and response system. We need to evaluate, we need to fund, to provide the funding if it is not sufficient. But you know, we submitted this report to the various policymakers, we submitted it to the Minister of Environment, to the Civil Protection Department itself, the Environmental Management Authority, to various companies. But yeah, sadly, a month later, we still had to come face to face with these disasters. So, in terms of the police, Zimbabwe has got some very good policies across the board. You know, when it comes to the issue of climate change, we have the National Climate Change Response Strategy, we have the Zimbabwe Climate Policy, we have all those renewable energy policies, and Zimbabwe is currently working on the on a national adaptation plan where they are going to make sure that these communities and the nation at large is prepared to adapt to the impacts of climate change. So we have got a number of policies that are relevant that could have been helpful. We have the laws, we have the policies, but the issue is lack of the implementation. We really lack when it comes to the implementation, be it in terms of the financial commitment, be it in terms of the technical equipment that are available to the civil protection departments. So I can't really say we need to keep on having lots and lots of policies, but we need to be serious when it comes to the implementations of those policies that we have at the moment before we even begin to think of coming up with new policies. Because we are all aware, the Minister of Climate, Agriculture, ITC, they have got the Climate Change Management Department that is responsible for research, that is responsible for informing the policymakers about this climate change, about the impacts of climate change, about these disasters that are going to befall on the people. So the policies are there, but the implementation is a bit lacking, and that's where we come in as civil society. We will continue to come up with these researches, we continue to raise awareness in the communities, we also continue to push on the policymakers, to push on the politicians, to push on the economists to really up their game and provide the necessary resources and provide the necessary political will and provide the necessary technical assistance that is necessary for us to respond to disasters in a proper and efficient way.
And this to any one of you here, I'm listening to the show, and well, I'm just wondering, what do I do? Do I call my MP? Do I call my district administrator? Do I call the councillor? What do I do to try to make sure things of this nature are given the right attention?
Yeah, well, of course, most of the time we really have to hold these representative institutions to account. For instance, the parliament, the local authorities. Like I said before, in terms of the Civil Protection Act, the local authorities are supposed to be part of this disaster response mechanisms. So all citizens, basically, they've got the duty, one, to make sure that these institutions are held accountable, that the Minister of Finance ensures that the adequate financial resources are held to the civil protection departments, that the civil protection departments itself, when it is set up, it is open in its operations, there's no room for corruption. You know, we may have resources going to the department, but then failing to be utilized when need arises, like in these days when we have let cycling die, and we all realized how ill-equipped we were, our departments were. So, obviously, at the end of the day, it is the duty not just of us in civil society, not just the duty of us in environmental law, not just the duty of renewable engineers or professionals, but it is the duty of all citizens to hold these institutions to account, to make sure that they know that when it comes to the issue of climate change, we are prepared to deal with climate-related disasters. So it is the duty of everyone to hold their legislators, their councillors accountable.
Before I go, a last word on this particular issue, while I look at a couple of messages that I think will add something else to the difference. Starting with you, Christine Jutta.
Come again?
Last words on the topic before we go.
Okay. In closing, I really just want to say we cannot overemphasize the seriousness of climate change in this day and age in Zimbabwe as a country. I think we definitely need to be more resilient. We need to raise awareness, and as was alluded to throughout the discussion, they definitely need to go back to the drawing board, hold people accountable, who are supposed to do what. Let's revisit that. And let's avoid that the next time we have a disaster, we are coming back again and talking about what went wrong, what was not done. We definitely need to pull up our socks. People need to work together. But I'll say that there's need for everybody has a role to play. The citizens have a watchdog role to play. We need to hold people accountable. The citizens themselves need to be knowledgeable, to understand the policies which are in place. Sometimes people don't even know that there's a civil protection unit, what it does, we're supposed to do what, so they don't also know who to hold accountable. So there's need also for us as citizens to be knowledgeable, to work and to be able to understand and identify who we can work with and where we can help. But overall, this was a very sad situation, quite regrettable, in that we could have done more to reduce the lives lost.
Professor Manasa?
Yes, I think we have learned a lesson, a very, very big lesson on disaster management. So I think all the institutions which are involved in the disaster management should up their sleeves and make sure that we don't have a repeat of what has happened.
Okay. And then finally, Lenin Shisaira.
Thanks a lot, Lara. I think my colleagues have really indicated what needs to be done. For myself, I was, I'll say, issues such as this program actually, I don't know, where we have begun to discuss a very critical issue in our lifetime. These are the programs that should continue to be conducted, you know, where people are really made aware of things that really affect them in their daily lives. We are now in the era of climate change. We need to be prepared. We need to have early warning systems. We need to have communication and media systems that give the information to the people. And also, we need to reward various institutions accountable.
That is the voice of Lenin Tinashe Sisaira, who is the environment lawyer and executive director at People and Earth Solidarity Law Network, and also from the same organization where Christine Jutta, who is the renewable energy engineer and trustee. And then also we had Professor Desmond Manatsa, Dean at the Faculty of Science and Engineering at the Bindira University of Science and Education. And speaking of particularly Professor Manatsa, there's a tweet that came here that I'm meant to read that had to do with you. Somebody was actually saying something. Oh, yes, this is Binyagadza at Binyagadza. Yes, Professor Manatsa from BUS, one of the few who have tangible and useful research in geosciences and engineering. Salutations to him. So there. Stay tuned to ZFM Stereo, my station, your station. Coming up is Chila with Our Story. And as I say, from where I come from, my name is Larry Kwirirai. Asiri, siyasebenza. Take care of yourself.